Theaetetus, a dialogue of Socrates with Euclides, Terption, Theodorus, and Theaetetus.
Just in from the country, Terption, or have you been back a while?
A fair while, and I was looking for you in the marketplace, wondering why I couldn't find you.
Because I wasn't in the city.
Where then?
On my way down to the harbor, I ran into Theaetetus being carried from Corinth, from the army camp, on his way to Athens.
Alive or dead?
Alive, but only just. He's in a bad way from some wounds, but what's really taking hold of him is the sickness that broke out in the army.
Not the dysentery.
Yes.
What a man to have in danger.
A fine and noble one, Terption. Just now, in fact, I was hearing people praising him warmly for his conduct in the battle.
Nothing strange in that. It would be far more astonishing if he weren't that kind of man. But why didn't he stop here in Megara?
He was in a hurry to get home. I begged him, I urged him, but he wouldn't hear of it. So I saw him on his way, and walking back I found myself remembering Socrates and marveling at how prophetic he was about this man among so much else. I believe it was shortly before his death that he met Theaetetus, then just a boy, and after spending time with him and talking with him, he was deeply impressed by his nature. When I went to Athens, he recounted to me the conversations he'd had with him, well worth hearing, and said the boy was absolutely bound to become someone of note if he lived to grow up.
And he spoke the truth, it seems. But what were those conversations? Could you recount them?
No, by Zeus, not from memory, not off the top of my head. But I made notes right away, as soon as I got home, and later, at my leisure, I wrote it out as I recalled it. And every time I went to Athens, I would ask Socrates again about whatever I hadn't remembered, and correct it when I got back here. So by now I have practically the whole conversation written down.
True, I've heard you say so before, and I've always meant to ask you to show it to me, but I've dawdled until now. Well, what's stopping us from going through it right away? I certainly need a rest anyhow after coming in from the country.
For that matter, I walked Theaetetus as far as Erineum myself, so I wouldn't mind a rest either. Let's go, and while we rest, the boy will read to us.
Good idea.
Here's the book, Terption. Now I wrote the conversation out this way, not with Socrates narrating it to me as he actually told it, but as if he were talking directly with the people he said he'd talked with. He said it was with Theodorus the Geometer and with Theaetetus. So that the narrative bits in between wouldn't clutter the written version, thee and I said, or and I remarked, whenever Socrates was speaking, or about the person answering, that he agreed, or he wouldn't grant it, I cut all that out and wrote it as if he were conversing with them himself.
Nothing wrong with that, Euclides.
Well then, boy, take the book and read.
If I cared more about the people of Cyrene, Theodorus, I'd be asking you about things there and about them, whether any of the young men over there are devoting themselves to geometry or any other branch of philosophy. But as it is, I love them less than I love these people here, and I'm more eager to know which of our own young men show promise of turning out well. That's what I keep an eye on myself as far as I can, and I ask the others too, anyone I see the young men choosing to spend time with. And no small number of them gather around you, and rightly so. You deserve it for geometry and for much else. So if you've come across anyone worth mentioning, I'd be glad to hear it.
Well, Socrates, it's certainly worth my telling, and you're hearing what a boy I've come across among your citizens. If he were beautiful, I'd be very afraid to say so, in case someone thought I was in love with him. But as it is, and don't be annoyed with me, he is not beautiful. He resembles you with the snub nose and the bulging eyes, though he has them less than you do, so I can speak without fear. I tell you, of all the boys I've ever met, and I've been around a great many, I've never yet noticed one so astonishingly gifted by nature. To be quick to learn, as few others are, and yet exceptionally gentle, and on top of that brave beyond anyone, I wouldn't have thought that combination could exist, and I don't see it occurring. the sharp ones like him, the quick-witted, the ones with good memories, are mostly also quick to flare up. They go darting about like ships without ballast, and grow up more manic than manly, while the steadier sort come to their studies sluggish somehow, loaded down with forgetfulness. But this one moves toward his lessons and inquiries so smoothly, so surely, so effectively, and with such perfect gentleness, like a stream of oil flowing without a sound, that it's a wonder someone his age gets these things done that way.
Good news, and whose son is he of our citizens?
I've heard the name, but I don't remember it. But he's the middle one of these boys coming toward us. He and some companions of his were just oiling themselves in the outer track, and now that they're done, I think they're coming this way. See if you know him.
I know him. He's the son of Euphronius of Sunium, very much, my friend, the sort of man you describe this boy to be and well thought of generally. What's more, he left a very large fortune. But I don't know the boy's name.
Theaetetus Socrates, that's his name. As for the fortune, I believe some trustees have run through it. Yet even so, he's astonishingly generous with money, Socrates.
A noble fellow, by your account. Ask him to come and sit here with us.
I will, Theaetetus, over here next to Socrates.
Yes, do, Theaetetus, so I can examine my own face and see what it looks like. Theodorus says it resembles yours. Now, suppose each of us had a lyre and he said they were tuned alike. Would we take his word for it right away, or would we look into whether he was a musician when he said it?
We'd look into it.
And if we found he was, we'd believe him. If he had no music in him, we wouldn't.
Drew.
But now, I take it, if we care at all about this likeness of faces, we need to consider whether he speaks as one with a painter's eye or not.
I think so.
Well, is Theodorus a painter?
Not as far as I know.
Nor a geometer either.
Of course he is, Socrates.
And an astronomer and a calculator, and a musician, everything that belongs to education.
I'd say so.
Then if he says we're alike in some feature of our bodies, whether in praise or blame, it's hardly worth paying him much attention.
Perhaps not.
But what if he praised the soul of one of us for virtue and wisdom? Wouldn't the one who hears the praise be right to be eager to examine the one praised, and the other be right to show himself off willingly?
Certainly, Socrates.
Then it's time, my dear Theaetetus, for you to show yourself and for me to examine. Because I assure you, Theodorus has praised many people to me, foreigners and citizens both, and he's never yet praised anyone the way he praised you just now.
That would be fine, Socrates, but watch out, he wasn't joking.
That's not Theodorus's way. Don't back out of what we've agreed on the pretext that he was joking, or he may be forced to testify. No one is going to charge him with perjury after all. So take heart and stand by the agreement.
Well, I must, if that's what you think.
Tell me then, you're learning some geometry from Theodorus.
I am.
And astronomy, too, and harmonics and calculation.
I'm doing my best, anyway.
So am I, my boy, from him and from anyone else I think knows something about these things. Still, though I manage well enough with them in general, there's one small point I'm stuck on, which I need to examine with you and these others. Tell me, isn't learning becoming wiser about the thing one is learning?
Of course.
And it's by wisdom, I take it, that the wise are wise.
Yes.
And does that differ at all from knowledge?
Does what differ?
Wisdom. Aren't people wise about exactly the things they have knowledge of?
Well, yes.
So knowledge and wisdom are the same thing?
Yes.
Well, that's exactly what I'm stuck on and can't adequately grasp on my own. Knowledge, what in the world is it? So can we say what it is? What do you all say? Which of us will speak first? Whoever misses and whoever keeps missing shall sit down and be donkey, as the children say in their ball game, and whoever comes through without a miss shall be our king and command us to answer whatever he pleases. Why the silence? Theodorus, I hope my love of argument isn't making me rude. In my eagerness to get us talking and make us friendly and conversable with one another.
Not at all, Socrates. Nothing rude in that. But do tell one of the boys to answer you. I'm unused to this kind of discussion, and I'm past the age for getting used to it. It would suit these boys, though, and they'd improve much more by it. Youth truly has room to grow in everything. So don't let Theaetetus off. Keep questioning him as you began.
You hear what Theodorus says, Theaetetus. You won't want to disobey him, I imagine, and it wouldn't be right for a younger man to disobey a wise man's instructions in matters like this. So speak up, well and nobly. What do you think knowledge is?
Well, I must, Socrates, since you both insist, and in any case, if I do slip somewhere, you'll set me straight.
Certainly, if we're able.
Then I think that the things one could learn from Theodorus are knowledges, geometry and the ones you went through just now, and then again shoemaking and the crafts of the other artisans, all of them and each of them, are nothing other than knowledge.
Nobly and open-handedly done, my friend. Asked for one thing, you give many, a rich variety instead of something simple.
What do you mean by that, Socrates?
Perhaps nothing, but I'll tell you what I think. When you say shoemaking, you mean nothing other than knowledge of the making of shoes.
Nothing else.
And when you say carpentry, anything other than knowledge of the making of wooden furnishings.
No, only that.
So in both cases, you're specifying what each knowledge is of.
Yes.
But that wasn't what was asked, Theaetetus. What knowledge is of, or how many knowledges there are. We didn't ask because we wanted to count them, but to grasp knowledge itself. What in the world it is? Or am I talking nonsense?
No, you're exactly right.
Now consider this, too. Suppose someone asked us a plain, ordinary question, say, about clay, what it is, and we answered him. There's the clay potter's use, and the clay used for oven makers, and the clay used by brickmakers. Wouldn't that be ridiculous?
Maybe.
For one thing, we'd be assuming the questioner understands, just from our answer, what clay means, whether we add the kind doll maker's use, or any other craftsman's kind. Or do you think anyone understands the name of a thing when he doesn't know what the thing itself is?
Not at all.
So someone who doesn't know what knowledge is doesn't understand knowledge of shoemaking either.
No, he doesn't.
So anyone who doesn't grasp knowledge doesn't grasp shoemaking or any other craft.
That's right.
So it's a ridiculous answer when someone is asked what knowledge is to answer with the name of some craft, since he's naming knowledge of some particular thing, when that wasn't the question.
So it seems.
And besides, when he could have given a plain, short answer, he wanders off down an endless road. Take the question about clay, it would have been plain and simple to say that clay is earth mixed with liquid, and let go of whose clay it is.
Put that way, Socrates, it does look easy. But I think you're asking the same kind of question that came up recently between me and my friend here, this other Socrates, when we were talking.
What sort of question, Theaetetus?
Theodorus here was working something out for us about powers showing, for the square of 3 feet and the square of 5 feet, that they aren't commensurable in length with the 1 foot square, and going through them one by one up to the square of 17 feet, where for some reason he got stuck. Since the powers seemed endless in number, it occurred to us to try to gather them into one thing, some single name to call all these powers by.
And did you find something like that?
I think we did see what you make of it yourself.
Go on.
We split all number into two kinds. The kind that can come out as an equal number multiplied by itself we likened in shape to a square, and called it square or equal-sided.
Very good so far.
Now the number in between the kind that includes 3 and 5 and every number that can't come out as an equal multiplied by itself, but only comes out as a smaller number taken more times or a larger number taken fewer times, so that it's always bounded by a larger side and a smaller side, that kind we liken to an oblong shape and called it oblong number.
Excellent. So what came next?
All the lines that square off the equal-sided plane number we marked off as length, and those that square off the oblong number we called powers, since they aren't commensurable in length with the others, but only in the plane areas they can produce. And there's another such distinction for solids.
Best of anyone, my boys. It seems to me Theodorus won't be liable for false testimony after all.
And yet, Socrates, what you're asking about knowledge, I couldn't answer the way I answered about length and power, though you seem to me to be after just that sort of thing. So once again, Theodorus turns out to have spoken falsely.
Well, now, if he'd praised you for running and said he'd never met a young man so fast, and then you raced the fastest man in his prime and lost, do you think his praise would have been any less true?
Not at all.
And knowledge? Do you think it's some small thing to track down, as I was just saying, and not a task for the very best?
By Zeus, I do think it's a task for the very best, the very hardest.
Then take heart about yourself and believe Theodorus and be eager, every way you can, to get hold of an account of knowledge along with everything else, of what it actually is.
As far as eagerness goes, Socrates, it will show itself.
Come then, you set us off well just now, try, imitating the answer about powers, the way you gathered those, many as they are, under one form. Try in the same way to address the many kinds of knowledge with one account.
But I assure you, Socrates, I've tried many times to work this out myself, hearing the questions reported from you. But I can't persuade myself that I've said anything adequate, nor have I heard anyone else say it the way you keep urging. And yet I can't shake off caring about it either.
That's because you're in labor. Dear Theaetetus, you're not empty. You're pregnant.
I don't know about that, Socrates. I'm just telling you what I feel.
Then, you absurd boy, haven't you heard that I'm the son of a midwife, a fine, sturdy woman named Phenarete?
I have heard that.
And have you heard that I practice the same trade?
Not at all.
Well, know that I do, only don't give me away to the others. It's a secret, my friend, that I have this skill. People, not knowing it, don't say this about me, but they do say I'm the strangest of men and that I get people stuck. Have you heard that too?
I have.
Shall I tell you the reason?
By all means.
Think through the whole business of midwives, and you'll grasp what I'm after more easily. You know, I suppose, that none of them still attends other women in labor while she herself is capable of conceiving and bearing. Only those who are already past childbearing do the delivering.
Quite so.
And the reason for that, they say, is Artemis, since she was allotted care of childbirth, though she herself never bears children. She didn't grant midwifery to the barren, since human nature is too weak to master a skill in something it has no experience of. But to those who, through age, no longer bear, she assigned it, honoring their likeness to herself.
That's likely.
And isn't this too likely, even necessary, that midwives are better than anyone else at recognizing who is pregnant and who isn't?
Quite so.
And more than that, by giving drugs and chanting charms, midwives can stir up labor pains and, if they choose, make them gentler. They can bring on birth for women having a hard time of it. And if it seems best to cause a miscarriage while it's still early, they do that too.
That's true.
Have you noticed this about them as well, that they're also the cleverest matchmakers? Since they're thoroughly wise about knowing which woman ought to be paired with which man so as to produce the best children.
I didn't know that at all.
Well, know that they take more pride in that than in cutting the cord. Think about it. Do you suppose it belongs to one craft or a different one, to tend and gather the crops of the earth, and also to know which soil suits which plant and seed.
Know the same craft.
And for a woman, my friend, do you think it's one craft for that and a different one for the gathering?
That doesn't seem likely.
No, it isn't. But because of the unjust, unskilled way of bringing a man and woman together, which goes by the name of pimping midwives, avoid matchmaking too, being women of honor, afraid of falling under that same charge on that account, since it's really only the true midwives who are fit to match couples correctly.
So it appears.
That then is the extent of what midwives do, and it's less than what I do. For it isn't the case with women that they sometimes bear phantoms and sometimes real children, with the difference hard to tell. If it were, distinguishing the true from the false would be the greatest and finest work of midwives, don't you think?
I do.
Well, my art of midwifery has everything theirs has, but differs in that I attend men, not women, and I watch over souls in labor, not bodies. And the greatest thing about my art is this. It's able to test in every way whether the young mind is bringing forth a phantom, something false, or something fertile and true. For this too belongs to me, just as it does to midwives. I myself am barren of wisdom. And the charge many have already brought against me that I question others but never state my own views about anything, because I have nothing wise in me, that charge is true. The reason for it is this. The God compels me to serve as midwife, but has forbidden me to give birth. So I myself am not at all wise, nor do I have any discovery of my own to show, born of my own soul. But those who keep my company, some seem quite stupid at first, yet as our association goes on, all of them, those the God allows, make progress that's astonishing, both to themselves and to others. And it's plain that this happens, though they never learn anything from me. They discover many fine things themselves, out of themselves, and simply bring them to birth. But the delivery is the work of the God and of me. Here's how you can see it. Many, not understanding this, have taken the credit to themselves and thought little of me, and either on their own or persuaded by others, have left me too soon. And once gone, they've miscarried the rest through bad company, and lost what I helped bring to birth by raising it badly, valuing lies and phantoms above the truth, until in the end they seemed, to themselves and everyone else, to be fools. Aristides, son of Lysimachus, was one of these, and a great many others besides. When they come back begging for my company again, doing extraordinary things to get it, sometimes the sign that comes to me forbids me to spend time with them. Sometimes it allows it, and then they make progress again. Now, those who keep company with me suffer this same thing that women in labor do. They're in pain and filled with confusion, night and day, far more than women are, and it's my art that can rouse this pain or put it to rest. So much for those. But there are others, Theaetetus, who don't seem to me to be pregnant at all in any way. And once I see they have no need of me, I very kindly play matchmaker for them. And if I may say so with the God's blessing, I'm quite good at guessing whose company would do them good. Many of these I've given over to Prodicus, and many to other wise and inspired men. I've gone on at such length, my excellent friend, for this reason. I suspect that you, as you think yourself, are in labor with something inside you. So come to me as to the son of a midwife, one who is himself skilled in midwifery, and do your best to answer whatever I ask in whatever way you can. And if, as I examine what you say, I judge it to be a phantom and not true, and quietly take it from you and throw it away, don't get angry the way first-time mothers do over their children. Many, my friend, have gotten so worked up at me that they're truly ready to bite. Whenever I remove some piece of nonsense from them, they don't think I'm doing it out of good will, being far from knowing that no God means humans harm, and that I do nothing of the sort out of ill will either. It's simply not permitted for me to let a falsehood stand and hide the truth away. So once more from the beginning, Theaetetus, try to say what knowledge is, and never say you can't. For if the god is willing and you play the man, you will be able.
Well, Socrates, with you urging me on like that, it would be shameful not to do everything I can to say what I have to say. It seems to me that someone who knows something perceives the thing he knows, and as it appears to me right now, knowledge is nothing other than perception.
Well said and bravely, my boy, that's how one ought to speak, stating one's view plainly. But come, let's examine it together and see whether it's something fertile or just wind. Knowledge, you say, is perception.
Yes.
You seem, though, to have stated no small account of knowledge, indeed the very one Protagoras used to give. He put it a different way, but it comes to the same thing. He says somewhere, that man is the measure of all things, of the things that are, that they are, and of the things that are not, that they are not. You've read that, surely.
I've read it many times.
Then he means something like this. As each thing appears to me, so it is for me, and as it appears to you, so it is for you, and you and I are both man.
Yes, that's what he says.
It stands to reason a wise man wouldn't talk nonsense. So let's follow him. Isn't it true that sometimes, when the same wind blows, one of us feels cold and the other doesn't, one a little, the other a lot?
Very much so.
Then are we going to say the wind itself, in itself, is cold or not cold? Or will we go along with Protagoras, that it's cold for the one who feels cold, and not for the one who doesn't?
It looks that way.
And it appears that way to each of them, too.
Yes.
And appearing is perceiving.
It is.
So appearance and perception are the same thing in matters of heat, and everything of that kind. Whatever each person perceives, that is, apparently, how things are for him.
It looks that way.
So perception is always of what is, and being knowledge, it can't be false.
So it seems.
Then, by the graces, was Protagoras some kind of all-round genius, who tossed this out to the common rabble like us as a riddle, while telling his students the truth in secret?
What do you mean by that, Socrates?
I'll tell you, and it's no small account either. It's this, that nothing is, in itself, just one thing you couldn't even correctly call anything by any particular name at all. But if you call something big, it will turn out to look small too, and if heavy, light, and so on for everything. On the ground that nothing is one thing, or of any particular sort, or any quantity at all. It's out of motion and change and mixture with one another that all the things we say are come to be, and we're wrong to call them that since nothing ever simply is. Everything is always coming to be. And on this point all the wise men in a row agree, except Parmenides and Protagoras, Heraclitus, Empedocles, and among the poets the top men of each genre, Epicharmus in comedy, Homer in tragedy. Homer, who spoke of ocean, the begetter of gods and Tethys their mother, meant that all things are the offspring of flux and motion. Or don't you think that's what he's saying?
I do.
Who, then, could stand up against so vast an army with Homer as its general, and not end up looking ridiculous?
It wouldn't be easy, Socrates.
No, it wouldn't, Theaetetus. And here's more evidence for the theory. What seems to be and coming to be are produced by motion, while not being and perishing come from rest. Heat itself, fire, which generates and governs everything else, is itself generated by friction and motion, and those are both kinds of motion. Aren't these the ways fire comes to be?
Yes, they are.
And the whole race of living things grows out of these same processes.
Of course.
And again, doesn't the condition of our bodies waste away under rest and idleness, but get preserved, largely, by exercise and movement?
Yes.
And the condition of the soul, doesn't it acquire learning and improve and stay sound through study and practice, which are both motions, while under rest, meaning lack of practice and lack of learning, it learns nothing and forgets whatever it did learn.
Very much so.
So motion is the good, for soul and body alike, and rest is the opposite.
So it seems.
Shall I go on windless calms, stillness of the sea, and all such things, how stillness rots things and destroys them, while the opposite preserves them? And to cap it all, I'll force in, I'll drag in the golden chain, which Homer means nothing other than the sun, showing that as long as the heavenly revolution and the sun keep moving, everything among gods and men exists and is preserved. But if that came to a stop, as if bound fast, everything would be destroyed, and it would all become, as the saying goes, turned upside down.
Well, Socrates, it does seem to me that this is what he's showing.
Then take it this way, my excellent friend. Start with the eyes. What you call the color white, don't think of it as some separate thing existing outside your eyes or even inside your eyes. Don't assign it any place at all. If you did, it would already have a fixed position, would stay put, and wouldn't be in a process of coming to be.
Then how should I think of it?
Let's follow the argument we just gave, and posit that nothing is in itself, a single, self-standing thing. On this view, black and white and any other color will appear to have come into being out of the collision of the eye with the appropriate motion, and what we call the color in each case will be neither the agent doing the striking nor the thing struck, but something in between, particular to each occasion. Or would you insist that whatever color appears to you, the same appears to a dog or to any other creature?
No, by Zeus, I wouldn't.
Well then, does anything appear the same to another person as it does to you? Are you confident of that, or far more confident that it isn't even the same to you yourself, since you're never in the same state as yourself from one moment to the next?
That seems more likely to me than the other.
Well then, if the thing we measure against, or touch, were itself big, or white, or hot, it could never become something different by coming into contact with something else, without itself changing. And conversely, if the thing doing the measuring or touching were itself any of these fixed things, then it too couldn't become something different just because something else approached it or was affected, without itself being affected. As it stands, my friend, we're being forced, rather too easily, into saying all sorts of strange and ridiculous things. The very things Protagoras and anyone arguing his position would say.
How so? What sort of things do you mean?
Take a small example and you'll see everything I mean. Say there are 6 knuckle bones. If you set 4 beside them, we say they are more than the 4, half again as many. But if you set 12 beside them, we say they are fewer, half as many. And no other way of speaking is tolerable. Or would you tolerate it?
I would not.
Well then, if Protagoras or anyone else asked you, Theaetetus, can anything become bigger or more in any way other than by being increased? What would you answer?
If I answer according to what seems true given this question, Socrates, I'd say no, it can't. But if I answer with the earlier question in mind, being careful not to contradict myself, I'd say yes, it can.
Well said by Hera, my friend, a truly inspired answer. Though it seems that if you answer yes, it can, something worthy of Euripides will follow. Our tongue will be unrefuted, but our mind will not.
Drill.
Now if you and I were clever and wise, having examined everything in our minds down to the last detail, we'd already be sparring with each other out of sheer surplus skill, colliding our arguments against each other's like sophists in a contest of that sort. But as it is, being ordinary people, we'll want first to look at the things themselves, to see what they really are that we have in mind, whether they agree with one another or not at all.
That is exactly what I would want.
And so would I, since that's how things stand. Shall we, calmly, as people with plenty of leisure, go back and examine ourselves again, not out of irritability, but really testing ourselves, As to what in the world these appearances within us are, looking at them first, I think we'll say that nothing could ever become bigger or smaller, either in bulk or in number, so long as it remains equal to itself. Isn't that so?
Yes.
Second, whatever has nothing added to it, and nothing taken away from it, never increases or decreases, but always stays equal.
Quite so.
And third, isn't it also true that whatever was not before, but is later, cannot be so without having come to be and being in the process of coming to be?
It does seem so.
These three admissions, I think, conflict with one another in our minds when we talk about the knuckle bones, or when we say that I, being the age I am, without growing or undergoing the opposite, am, within a year, bigger than you, who are young now and later smaller, not because anything has been taken away from my bulk, but because you have grown. For I am later what I was not before, without having become so, since it's impossible to become something without the process of coming to be, yet without losing any of my bulk I could never become smaller. And countless other things like this happen too, if we're going to accept these premises. You're following me, I take it, Theaetetus. You don't strike me as inexperienced in these matters.
Yes, by the gods, Socrates, I'm astonished overwhelmingly at what these things could possibly be. And sometimes, looking straight at them, I really do feel dizzy.
Theodorus, my friend, seems to have judged your nature well. This feeling, wonder, is very much the mark of a philosopher. Philosophy has no other starting point than this, and whoever said Iris was the child of Thaumas was tracing her lineage well. But do you understand yet why these things are as they are, given what we say Protagoras means, or not yet?
Not yet, I think.
Then will you be grateful to me if I help you dig out, along with you, the truth hidden in the thinking of a man, or rather, of several famous men?
Of course I'll be grateful, very much so.
Look around, then, and make sure none of the uninitiated are listening. These are the people who think nothing is real except what they can grip firmly with both hands, who won't accept actions, or comings to be, or anything invisible, as part of reality.
Well, Socrates, the men you're describing certainly sound tough and hard-headed.
They are, my boy, thoroughly graceless, but there are others much subtler whose mysteries I'm about to reveal to you. Their starting point from which everything we've just been saying hangs is this, that everything is motion and there is nothing besides motion. But motion comes in two kinds, each infinite in number, one having the power to act, the other to be acted upon. Out of their meeting and rubbing against each other come offspring, infinite in number but always born in pairs, on one side something perceived, on the other a perception, always emerging and being generated together with the thing perceived. Our perceptions have names like these: sight, hearing, smell, feelings of cold and of heat, and also pleasures and pains, desires and fears, and others besides, countless ones without names, and a great many that do have names. And the class of perceptible things, in turn, is born alongside each kind of perception, colors of every sort alongside sight, sounds likewise alongside hearing, and other perceptible things akin to each of the other perceptions. Now what is this story meant to tell us, Theaetetus, in relation to what came before? Do you see it?
Not entirely, Socrates.
Then pay attention and see if it comes together. What it means to say is that all these things, as we've been saying, are in motion, but there is speed and slowness in their motion. Whatever is slow keeps its motion fixed in place, directed at what comes near it, and in that way it generates. And what is generated in this way moves faster since it is carried along, and motion is, by nature, in that carrying. So whenever an eye and some other thing commensurate with it come near each other and generate whiteness, together with the perception connatural to it, things that would never have come to be if either of those two had gone toward something else instead, then, while sight travels from the eyes and whiteness travels from the thing that co-produces the color, In the space between them, the eye becomes filled with sight, and so comes to see, and becomes not sight itself, but a seeing eye. While the thing that joined in generating the color becomes saturated with whiteness, and becomes not whiteness itself, but a white thing, whether it turns out to be a piece of wood, a stone, or whatever else happens to be colored with that color. And we should think the same way about everything else, hard, hot, all of it. None of these things is anything in itself, as we said before. They all come to be in all their varieties out of the interaction of things in motion. Because even the notion of a fixed agent or patient, something that acts and something acted upon, each taken separately, doesn't hold up, as the wise say. Nothing is an agent until it meets something to act on, and nothing is acted upon until it meets something acting. And whatever meets one thing and acts turns out, when it collides with something else, to be acted upon instead. So out of all this, which is exactly what we said from the start, nothing is ever one thing, fixed in itself, but always something coming to be for something else, and being has to be struck out everywhere, even though force of habit and plain ignorance have just made us use the word ourselves, repeatedly. But that's not allowed, according to the theory of the wise. We mustn't grant that anything is something, or someone's, or mine, or this, or that, or give it any name that makes it stand still. We should speak in accordance with nature and say things are coming to be, being made, perishing, changing, since anyone who makes something stand still in speech is easily refuted. And this has to apply piece by piece and also to things gathered into groups, which is the kind of grouping people label a man or a stone or any given animal or kind. Well, Theaetetus, does all this seem pleasant to you? Would you taste it and find it agreeable?
I really don't know, Socrates. In fact, I can't even tell about you whether you're saying what you actually think or just testing me.
You forget, my friend, that I myself know nothing and claim nothing of this sort as my own. I'm barren of such things. I act as midwife for you, and that's why I chant incantations and serve you tastes from each of the wise until I've helped bring your own view out into the light. Once it's delivered, I'll examine whether it turns out to be wind or something with real substance. So take heart, be patient, and answer bravely and honestly whatever seems true to you about what I ask.
Go on and ask, then.
Tell me again, then. Does it please you to say that nothing simply is, but everything is always coming to be, good, beautiful, and all the things we just went through?
Yes, for my part, hearing you lay it out this way, it strikes me as remarkably sound, and I think it has to be accepted just as you've explained it.
Then let's not leave out what's still missing. What remains concerns dreams, and illnesses, including madness, and all the cases of mishearing, misseeing, or misperceiving in some other way. You know, I suppose, that in all these cases the theory we just went through seems, by common agreement, to be refuted, since in them, more than anywhere, false perceptions occur in us, and far from it being true that what appears to each person also is, quite the opposite. None of the things that appear actually is.
That's very true, Socrates.
Then what theory is left, my boy, for someone who claims perception is knowledge, and that what appears to each person also is, for the one to whom it appears?
I hesitate to say I have nothing to answer, Socrates, since you just scolded me for saying that very thing. But I honestly couldn't dispute that madmen and dreamers hold false beliefs, when some of them think they're gods, and others think they're birds and imagine themselves flying in their sleep.
Don't you also notice a further puzzle about these cases, especially about waking and dreaming?
What puzzle?
One you've surely heard people raise before. What proof could someone offer, if asked right now, whether we're asleep and dreaming everything we're thinking, or awake and genuinely talking with each other?
Really, Socrates, it's hard to see what proof one could give. Everything lines up as if in matching pairs. The very conversation we're having now could just as well be something we imagine having in our sleep, and whenever we dream that we're telling our dreams, the resemblance between the two is uncanny.
So you see, it's not hard to raise the dispute, since even whether we're awake or dreaming is disputable. And given that we spend roughly equal time in each state, in both cases our soul insists that whatever it currently believes is true beyond anything else, so that for equal stretches of time we claim these things are real, and equally we claim those other things are real, and we're just as adamant on both sides.
Absolutely.
And doesn't the same reasoning apply to illness and madness too, except that the time involved isn't equal?
Right.
Well then, will truth be decided by how much or how little time something lasts?
That would be absurd in all sorts of ways.
But can you point to anything else clear enough to show which of these beliefs are true?
I don't think so.
Then listen to me, and hear what those who define whatever seems true to someone as actually true for them would say about all this. I imagine they put the question this way: Theaetetus, whatever is entirely different from something else, could it possibly share any power at all with that other thing? And let's not assume that the thing we're asking about is the same in one respect and different in another. No, let's mean wholly different.
Then it's impossible for it to have anything the same, whether in power or in any other respect, when it is completely different.
And isn't it also necessary to grant that such a thing is unlike the other?
I think so.
So if it happens that something becomes like or unlike something else, whether like itself or like something else, we'll say that in becoming like, it becomes the same, and in becoming unlike, it becomes different.
Necessarily.
Now, didn't we say earlier that the things acting are many and unlimited, and likewise the things acted upon?
Yes.
And also that one thing combined with another, and again with yet another, will generate not the same results but different ones?
Certainly.
Then let's take you and me and everything else by the same reasoning, Socrates healthy and Socrates sick again. Shall we say this one is like that one, or unlike it?
Do you mean the sick Socrates as a whole, compared to the whole healthy Socrates?
You've grasped it exactly. That's just what I mean.
Unlike, surely.
And therefore different, just as it's unlike.
Necessarily.
And you'll say the same about Socrates asleep, and all the other cases we just went through.
I will.
So each of the things whose nature it is to act on something, will it treat healthy Socrates as one thing to work on, and treat sick Socrates as another?
Of course.
And in each of these two cases, will generate different results, I who am acted upon, and that thing which acts.
Naturally.
So when I, being healthy, drink wine, it appears to me pleasant and sweet.
Yes.
Because, following what we've already agreed, the agent and the patient generated sweetness together with a perception, both moving in tandem. The perception, coming from the side of the one acted upon, made the tongue perceiving, while the sweetness, coming from the wine and moving around it, made the wine both be and appear sweet to the healthy tongue.
Yes, that's exactly what we agreed earlier.
But when I'm sick, in truth, didn't it first meet a different me? For it approached someone unlike the other.
Yes.
So this Socrates in this condition and the drinking of the wine, together, generated something different again. A perception of bitterness around the tongue, and a bitterness coming to be and moving around the wine. And the wine becomes not bitterness but bitter, and I become not perception but one perceiving.
Exactly so.
So I myself will never become anything else in this same way of perceiving, for a perception of one thing is different from a perception of another, and it makes the perceiver different and other. Nor will that thing which acts on me, ever meeting something else, generate the same result and remain what it was. For by generating something different from something different, it will itself become different.
That's so.
And I am not the same to myself, either, nor will that other thing be the same to itself.
No, indeed.
But it's necessary that I become something's, mine, that is, of some object, whenever I come to be perceiving, for it's impossible to become one perceiving while perceiving nothing. And that other thing must become something's, too, whenever it comes to be sweet or bitter or anything of the sort, for it's impossible for it to become sweet without being sweet to someone.
Absolutely.
So what's left to us, I think, is to be bound to each other, if we exist, to exist for each other, and if we come to be, to come to be for each other, since necessity binds our very being together, yet binds it to nothing else, not even to ourselves alone. So what's left is that we're bound together with one another. So whether someone speaks of being or becoming, he must say it is being or becoming for someone, or of something, or in relation to something. But being or becoming, something on its own, in itself, that he must neither say himself, nor accept from anyone else who says it, as the argument we've gone through shows.
Absolutely right, Socrates.
So then, since whatever acts on me belongs to me and to no one else, I'm the one who perceives it, and no one else.
Of course.
So my perception is true for me, since it always belongs to my own being, and I am, as Protagoras says, judge of the things that are, that they are for me, and of the things that are not, that they are not.
So it seems.
So then, being free from falsehood, and never stumbling in my thinking about the things that are or come to be, how could I fail to have knowledge of the very things I perceive?
There's no way you could fail to.
So it's been beautifully said by you, that knowledge is nothing other than perception, and it all comes together into one, according to Homer and Heraclitus and the whole tribe of people like them, that everything moves like flowing streams. According to Protagoras, wisest of all, that man is the measure of all things. And according to Theaetetus, given all this, that perception becomes knowledge. Isn't that right, Theaetetus? Shall we call this newborn child yours and my delivery of it? Or how do you put it?
It has to be so, Socrates.
This, then, it seems, we've finally managed to give birth to, whatever it actually turns out to be. But after the delivery, we really do need to run the child around in a circle in our discussion, the way people do at the naming ceremony, to make sure we're not missing that what's been born isn't worth raising at all, but is only wind and falsehood. Or do you think we absolutely must raise whatever's yours and not set it aside? Or will you put up with seeing it examined and refuted, and not get too angry if someone, as with a firstborn, tries to take it away from you?
Theaetetus will put up with it, Socrates. He's not at all difficult that way. But in God's name, tell us in what way it isn't so.
You really are a lover of argument, Theodorus, and a good one. If you think I'm some kind of sack full of arguments, ready to pull one out easily and say that after all this isn't how things are. But you don't notice what's actually happening, that none of the arguments comes from me at all, but always from whoever is talking with me. I myself know nothing beyond a little, just enough to take an argument from another wise person and receive it fairly. And now I'll try to get this from our friend here, not say it myself.
You put it better that way, Socrates, do it so.
Do you know, then, Theodorus, what I find strange about your friend Protagoras?
What is it?
Everything else he said pleases me very much, that whatever seems true to each person is true for them. But I'm puzzled by the opening of his argument, that he didn't begin his book called Truth by saying that the measure of all things is a pig, or a dog-headed baboon, or some still stranger creature capable of perception. That would have been a truly grand and utterly contemptuous way to begin speaking to us, showing us that while we were admiring him for his wisdom as if he were a god, he was in fact no better in intelligence than a tadpole, let alone any other human being. What are we to say, Theodorus? If whatever each person judges true through perception really will be true for him, and no one can judge another's experience better than he can, nor is anyone in a better position to examine whether another's belief is right or wrong. But rather, as has been said many times, each person alone will judge his own beliefs, and all of them will be correct and true. Then why on earth, my friend, is Protagoras so wise as to be rightly regarded as a teacher of others, and paid handsomely for it? While we are more ignorant and ought to go sit at his feet, when each of us is, in himself, the measure of his own wisdom, how can we avoid saying that Protagoras is just playing to the crowd with this? As for my own art of midwifery, and how much ridicule we bring on ourselves, and the whole practice of dialectic along with it, I say nothing. For isn't examining and trying to refute one another's impressions and opinions, when each person's opinions are correct, an enormous and endless piece of nonsense? If Protagoras's truth really is true, and wasn't just speaking playfully from the inner sanctuary of his book.
Socrates, he's a friend of mine, as you just said. So I wouldn't want Protagoras refuted through my agreeing to things, nor would I want to resist you against my own judgment. Take up Theaetetus again. He seemed to be following you quite gracefully just now.
Theodorus, if you went to Sparta and visited the wrestling grounds, would you think it fair to watch other men naked, some of them in poor shape, without stripping down yourself and showing your own form?
Well, what do you think, if they were going to let me off and be satisfied, just as I think I'll persuade you too to let me watch and not drag me, stiff as I already am, onto the mat, but wrestle instead with this younger, more supple fellow?
Well, Theodorus, if that's your pleasure, it's no trouble to me either, as the proverb goes. So back we go to our wise Theaetetus. Tell me, Theaetetus, about what we just went through. Doesn't it strike you as strange that you should suddenly turn out to be, in wisdom, no worse than any man alive, or even any god? Or do you think Protagoras's measure applies less to gods than to men?
No, by Zeus, I don't, and that's exactly what puzzles me about your question. When we were going through how people say that what seems to each person is also true for the one it seems to, it struck me as very well put, but now it's suddenly flipped to the opposite.
That's because you're young, my dear boy. You're quick to catch the drift of a popular speech and let it persuade you. Protagoras, or someone speaking for him, will answer this. You find fellows, old and young alike, sitting there making speeches together and dragging the gods into it, gods I steer clear of, both in speaking and writing, as to whether they exist or not. And you say what the crowd would gladly accept hearing, namely how terrible it would be if each human being were no better in wisdom than any random farm animal. But you offer no proof, no necessity whatsoever. You just rely on plausibility. And if Theodorus or any other geometer wanted to do geometry that way, he wouldn't be worth a thing. So you and Theodorus had better consider whether you're willing to accept arguments about matters this important resting on mere persuasiveness and plausibility.